This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News. Well, a group of top vaccine experts meeting today, also tomorrow, to consider whether people who get the COVID-19 vaccines made by Moderna and J&J should receive booster shots. This is continuing to kind of figure out who needs what, right?
Who needs what and when, right?
Exactly.
The U.S. FDA is going to send Merck's COVID-19 pill to an advisory committee for review, using a public forum to discuss any safety concerns ahead of a potential authorization. Remember, this is treatment.
Right.
So really could change the game for people who are infected with COVID.
All right. So that's some of the broader, bigger stories when it comes to COVID-19. Dr. Penny Wheeler is someone we have reached out to throughout the pandemic. She's president and CEO at Allina Health. They have a lot of hospitals, I think over 10. I think it's about a dozen in the Minnesota area. And so they have really a front row seat to what's been going in the Midwest when it comes to COVID. She's back with us on the phone from Minnesota. Dr. Wheeler, it is so nice to have you back with us. This, you know, COVID, I think we all had hoped by now that we'd be beyond it, but we're not. What's going on in the Midwest?
Well, we sure wish we were beyond it.
Yeah.
Here, you know, unfortunately, the country as a whole is going down from the Delta variant, but we are still peaking here. So it seemed like the whole a variant and its infectivity moved north. So we're seeing cases here that are exceeding even our second highest peak right now. And the situation's changed because the staffing is so challenging everywhere. So it's tough going right now. In the words of one doctor that I heard of, just to show you the strain, he said, "I don't know whether to drive for my shift in the ED or to drive into the reservoir. It's that taxing for our caregivers who are just doing amazing work."
Can you give us any numbers about what you're seeing in the 13 hospitals and more than 90 clinics with who is being affected right now, who's hospitalized right now, and the portion of those who are or not who are not vaccinated?
Yeah, I sure can. We at Allina take care about 25% of the people who are hospitalized with COVID in our states. We're a pretty good litmus test. The vast majority of the people requiring hospitalization are unvaccinated. 88% of the people in our ICUs right now, intensive care units are unvaccinated. And that's where we're seeing the primary really severe illness and sadly, way too many deaths occurring. So that's still the case. So again, the numbers are in this geography still rising rather than falling.
What's the risk planning or contingency planning that you guys are doing in anticipation of another wave potentially or a variant that trips us up again?
Yeah, well, certainly, you know, a lot of it has to do with, how can we have adequate staffing available? So a lot of our leaders are taking frontline positions and trying to bolster the staffing. We're trying to eliminate things that are unnecessary so that we can accommodate the surge. We're having, we have a centralized access center so it can level load, where people can go if one hospital's full, then another hospital take it. And we do that actually with the whole state of Minnesota and the other health systems in the state. As well. So we're trying to do some of those things to accommodate the needs. COVID is a big need, but we're also seeing delayed care needs of significance all at a time when staffing is really challenged.
Yeah.
Dr. Wheeler, help us set expectations for what things look like in 2022, 2023, 2024. Carol and I are flying today, tonight. It's the first time I've gone on a long flight. Your first time flying, Carol, in what, 18 months?
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to be wearing masks throughout the flight at the airport. Is this something we're going to be doing for the rest of our lives?
Yeah, it's a good question. I wish I could predict. It's what has happened is we can only kind of see almost 2 to 3 weeks ahead of us. And beyond that, I mean, I wouldn't have predicted this, you know?
Yeah, right.
Beyond that, it's really hard to predict. I think that some of the rise in the cases are because of school openings, and I think that the more vaccinations we can get into the pediatric population, that will help as well. I think we're also realizing that some of what Japan did traditionally, we probably should do more of in terms of masking when we're not well. So some of that behavior probably should stay with us to keep people safe.
Gotta
but
say,
it's hard to predict long term.
Yeah, I've definitely gotten much more comfortable with wearing a mask. I feel like I almost miss it sometimes when I'm out and about walking and it's not there. Just want to ask you, you guys are transitioning. You're going to have a new CEO and you're going to move off to, I believe, the board. Tell us a little bit about that transition.
Yeah, well, you know, these people are so amazing. It's going to be these people with what they've accomplished for the communities that I will miss the most. But I am so grateful for the organization I love to transition it to, our chief operating officer and president, Lisa Shannon, who's just really solid. So a real smooth transition. Our employees don't need any more disruption than they already have. And that to stay on the board and have that continuity is really important for us and the communities we serve.
Well, it sounds like you've been a great leader. I know you guys have been had so much to have to deal with, certainly in this, and we're not out of it, out of the woods yet.
No.
And we have really leaned on you in terms of getting your perspective. So thank you so much, and you take care. Dr. Penny Wheeler, President and Chief Executive Officer at Allina Health, on the phone from Minnesota. I do think this is just a way of life.
It is.
To some extent.
Yeah, I think it is, too. I mean, there's the before times and the after times, right? We kind of joke about it, but it really is. It's going to be the way that we live with it. And I think that we're getting more and more used to it. I think the kids part of it is different because there are no vaccines yet for many kids.
But hopefully getting closer to it.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
U.S. initial jobless claims, we've been talking about it, dropping to the lowest since March of 2020. Meantime, prices paid to U.S. producers rose in September. We also heard about that from Charlie, at the slowest pace of the year. And what we're seeing, Tim, is cooling costs of services, including airfares, as the Delta variant impacted demand. So that's pretty significant.
It is pretty significant. And to join us to help us dig through these numbers and all this data is Reed Picker, U.S. economy reporter at Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from Washington. Reed, it is always great to have you on the show. Thanks for joining us today. Where do you want to start? Do you want to start with initial jobless claims or do you want to start with PPI? What do you think is more important?
So they're both important, but let's start with claims. And thanks for having me on the show. It's always fun to be here. In terms of them falling below 300,000, I mean, it's great news all around, especially when you think about the fact of, you know, the pre-pandemic level of these claims in what was one of the best job markets in years was around 215,000 or so a week. And I think what it really shows you when we think about this labor, very confusing labor market that we're in, is we're in a jobs market where quits are at record levels, turnover is high, and businesses are struggling to fill open positions. So, you know, employers are very much trying to hold on to their workers. And, you know, from an inflation perspective, we've seen that in terms of folks raising wages, offering all kinds of incentives and bonuses. But yeah, I think the labor market is in a very interesting state right now, but the jobless claims figures really point us in that direction of things are getting better.
I just thinking, as you're talking about this, Reed, I'm just thinking about Domino's Pizza, the company reporting earnings today and saying that it can't get enough people to cook and deliver pizzas, which actually hurt sales for the most recent quarter, Carol. So this has a significant economic impact.
Right. We just heard from Penny Wheeler over at Allina Health. Healthcare, she can't get enough workers. It's just everywhere. But nonetheless, this is a better sign when it comes to what we've been seeing in the labor market. And this is important, right? Because the jobs market, the monthly jobs markets are backward looking. And so this gives us a better feel of real-time data.
Absolutely. And, you know, I don't think anyone has a great handle on what's going on. But, you know, one piece that I thought was really good today, Katya Dmitrieva and Jill Shaw actually had a really nice Business Week piece that was talking about some of the stories of folks who aren't working right now and why, you know, despite the fact that we have these near record job openings. But I will say, you know, looking at the silver lining of this, I mean, from a worker perspective, you know, we have the highest quits rate on record, which shows that a lot folks have a lot of confidence that they can find a new job, whether that's a job that fits their lifestyle better, has better hours, has better pay, whatever it may be. And, you know, we've seen pretty robust wage gains as well as employers try to attract these folks. So from a worker perspective, I mean, it is a good time to, you know, be a worker. And from that point of the labor market, it's quite tight, which has, you know, obviously had implications for the Fed as well.
Right.
Let's talk about those other numbers. I'm just thinking, is it a good speed? You know, I'm hearing this and it's like Domino's can't get workers. We just heard from the CEO of Allina Health. And we're getting into the end of the year. Let's talk producer price index, though, and what we learned this morning, the smallest advance in quite a while, Reid.
Yeah. And, you know, and that comes on the heels of the CPI data that we got a little bit earlier this week. And it was good news in some ways because we saw some of that services inflation cool down a little bit. But we also saw pretty robust inflation from the goods side. You know, the way that I often think about the economy where we are right now is we have slower growth and higher inflation than many economists were expecting just a few months ago. And, you know, in terms of the growth picture, you know, we've essentially seen that consumer spending in the third quarter has proven to be much weaker than economists thought a few months ago. A large part of that is Delta, but you've also got these massive supply chain disruptions that are wreaking havoc on growth and wreaking havoc on the PPI index, as well as consumer prices. I just think of something like ISM manufacturing data, where you've got solid new orders growth,
right,
but producers can't get the scale of materials
right.
They need to fill those orders.
It's data points that investors certainly seem to be pretty happy about. Bloomberg News U.S. economic reporter Reid Pickert.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
This is among our most read. In fact, I think it might still be the most read on the Bloomberg in the past 8 hours. It's also today's big take. It's part of an ongoing Business Week online series here at Bloomberg. And this one in particular takes a look at how wealthy New Yorkers are getting a steal on property taxes. You heard it right, Tim.
Jason Grotto is senior investigative reporter at Bloomberg News. He joins us now on the phone from Chicago. Jason, it's great to have you on the show. Congratulations to you and the rest of the team on today's big take. I read this story and I thought to myself, you know what? It is so true. When you look at real estate in New York City, the amount of money that so many condos are worth, it is shocking to see how low some of the property taxes are. You found a $2 million condo in Brooklyn that only pays $157 a year in property taxes. Why is that?
Well, first, thanks so much for having me. It's the result of a system that, you know, over the last 30 years or so has been, you know, added to and just become incredibly complex. And the low tax bill on that particular condo is the result of two things. One is the extreme undervaluation of condo and cooperative of the market values that the city comes up with. And then the other is the very generous exemptions and abatements that are provided to certain condos and cooperatives that drive the bills down even further.
Well, and you guys looked into a ton of city records when it came to condo sales and taxes. So tell us, in terms of your takeaway, is it policy? Is it something that just has been not noticed? Like, how does something like this perpetuate for so long?
Well, yeah, that's right. So we ended up analyzing millions of property tax records in New York City and found, you know, a consistent pattern. First, that the city drastically undervalues these properties by the magnitude of about 80%. And the other thing that we found is that the valuations have a pattern. Lower priced properties are overvalued relative to market prices, market values, and higher priced ones are undervalued. And so the first part of the process where everyone is overvalued, it really obscures the second part, which is known as regressivity. Essentially, New York has a regressive property tax system. And the low valuations mask that. Because, you know, if I own a $200,000 home and they're only capturing $85,000 of my value, I'm thinking, hey, I'm getting a good deal. What I don't know is that the person who owns a $2 million home, they're only capturing, you know, or $200,000 of that. So, you know, one might be getting 37% of their value captured, and the higher end property will be getting about, you know, 13%. And that skews the tax bills for the entire city, that valuation process.
Right. Jason, this is one of those stories that I encourage everyone to read online because there's an interactive element to it. And there are some amazing visuals that show on a chart how much a condo is worth and the portion of that that they're paying in property taxes per year. And it's pretty mind-boggling to see, and you really have to look at it to just understand the magnitude of it. So what is New York City, what do they say about this? Because they are leaving money on the table.
Yeah, so we were not granted any interviews with the city despite months of trying. You know, what do they do about it, you know, is kind of the big question. And the problem here is that this issue has been going on for so long that the market itself, the real estate market itself, has incorporated these skewed taxes into actual values. They've capitalized them. So untangling this is going to be a real problem. And that's one reason why it hasn't been fixed in 30 years. You know, there have been three mayoral efforts to try to fix the property tax system in New York. So people are well aware that there's, you know, underlying problems. But, you know, in order to fix it, you're talking about a massive wealth transfer. People who own really high-end condos and co-ops will be taxed at much higher rates, which could impact the value of the property. And that, in a nutshell, is why it's so hard to fix.
You can't help but feel, I have to say, we went through recently like a tax reassessment, and like everybody was like, well, wait, what is your property? Like, how, you know, and I feel like as transparency, or if this data was all put out there, and everybody, certainly those who are benefiting might not so want that stuff put out there, but if you are being penalized, you're going to be like, well, wait a minute, this isn't fair.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, first of all, New York is not alone in this, in these issues.
Good to know.
We published a story earlier this year looking at this at a nationwide level, and we found that this problem of regressivity is inherent in jurisdictions across the country. New York is huge, and it is particularly bad, and kind of as New York goes, so does the rest of the country. So we wanted to drill down into New York. But, you know, the thing that you're touching on, the transparency piece, is key.
Yeah.
If people can't see clearly, it's very hard to understand what's going on.
What is the relationship between landlords and this policy? Because I think to myself, okay, well, New York City is a place where a lot of people rent, and I wonder to what extent landlords have had favorable tax advantages.
Well, what we found is that actually the effective tax rate, which is really just, you know, the property tax bill divided by the value, the market price of the property, we found that rental properties actually pay a higher effective tax rate than condos and condos, because that was what we studied, but cooperatives are valued the same way. And what that means is they're in the same what they call tax class. So it's a matter of how is the distribution of the property tax burden, how is it distributed? And within a tax class, everyone should be paying the same effective tax rate. And what we found is that condominiums are pay much lower effective tax rates than rentals. And what that means is, you know, to the extent that landlords pass the cost of taxes onto their tenants, rents are higher than they would be potentially if those taxes were lower. Of course, landlords might pocket a lot of that money as well. So it's a very complex problem. But, you know, what it means is a lot of the burden is being shifted onto rental properties.
Yeah, that's interesting. Sounds like nothing's going to change. Just got about 30 seconds here, right, at this point?
Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be very, very difficult. The political optics of it are very bad. And sort of the lesson, you know, that we're writing for a national audience, and the lesson is don't let it get this bad.
Hmm. Nothing gets people going though like property taxes. Right?
Any
in
taxes,
terms of assessment.
I think, right?
You mean taxes in general?
Yeah.
Jason, thank you. It is an in-depth story. And as Tim said, check out it online because there is a lot of interactive components to it and a lot of information in detail.
Yeah, you can see Jason's story. It's available at Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. You can also get to it on the Bloomberg terminal. All you got to do is type in NI Big Take or just N Big Take.
Jason Grotto, he's senior investigative reporter at Bloomberg News, joining us on the phone from Chicago.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive home.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
So just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up the Thursday trade. We are hovering near our highs, as you just heard from Charlie, just off of them, but nonetheless a rally underway. Earnings, a big reason why, and we're going to get into that economic data too, but let's break it down. Let's get to the drive to the close with Bloomberg News markets reporter Abigail Doolittle. She is on the phone in our New York City bureau. It is definitely a risk on trade, and it's broad-based in terms of the rally.
It certainly is, Carol. We're looking at the best day for the S&P 500, as Charlie was mentioning, up 1.6% since March. The NASDAQ also up the same amount. That's the best day since May. So that's the degree of the buying power. And speaking to the broad-based nature of the rally, all 11 of the S&P 500 sectors are higher, most by about 1% or more. The best is materials, up 2.3%. That has everything to do with the rally in metals, materials, and then tech, and that has a lot to do with the fact that yields are down yet another day, relieving valuation concerns. So it's a really nice day for stocks, for sure.
Hey, Abigail, talk a little bit about the SOX, the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index, because it is having a day. At one point, higher by more than 2.4%. And at one point, there were no stocks in the SOX in the red.
You know, this is an interesting one for sure, Tim, from the standpoint that the SOX, similar to the Russell 2000, that small cap index, in recent days has been testing its 200-day moving average, something that the other indexes have not done. That's long-term support, the long-term buyers, and yet its 50-day moving average is rounding down, telling you that the near-term buyers are not around. The dip buyers are gone. But today, you have the SOX right in between. This is a range. We're seeing ranges on other indexes, too, and a range is all about information, or all about uncertainty. Folks are waiting for more information, and I believe that we'll probably gather more information on a micro level from the earnings reports. Everybody wants to know not so much about demand, but about supply, margins, the supply chains, and then, of course, rates. Are rates going higher or are they going lower?
And forgive me, the stock's higher by more than 2.8% as
big
we speak.
Yes.
So wait, were you just talking about the stocks or the S&P 500?
The stocks.
The stocks with the 50-day. You said the trend line has been moving lower, correct?
Well, they're both very similar. The difference between the stocks and the S&P 500, the stocks has been in a range for much of the year, so it's been testing that 200-day moving average, whereas the S&P 500 is between the 100 and 50-day moving average. But the same idea, these range down trading areas where investors just don't know. The buyers don't have enough information to create new all-time highs yet, and the sellers don't feel confident enough to push these indexes lower. If the 50-day moving averages are sloping to the downside, some technicians really consider that to be an early sign of potential weakness.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. I mean, bottom line, a healthy move that we're seeing today, reactive move. What can you tell from those technicals and the internals?
Right now, great question, Carol. It's probably a little bit more reactive until you have a break out of the range. The range is exciting in terms of these up and down moves. Each week it seems to be up and then down and then up and down and grabs a lot of attention. But the thing you really want to watch is to see which way the range breaks. And we just don't know. We're right in the middle. It's going to come down to earnings and it will come down to inflation and rates.
You know, it's interesting. I've got a 6-month up on the S&P 500. And for a long time, even though as we pulled back, it was like this almost steady line to the upside until we got to, what was it, like rolling over in August, and then it's really been choppy. So the one thing we know for certain is that there's more volatility in this market.
For sure. Volatility breeds volatility, and that's a terrific point on the S&P 500. That uptrend had been beautiful for such a long time.
So clean, right?
So clean, and now more holding that 50-day moving average time after time after time, telling you those dip buyers were there. But over the last 3 months, slowly but surely, the index has been rolling over a little bit. Not a lot, but it's flattening. And when you have a flattening market, it breaks the uptrend, suggesting that there's enough uncertainty that you could see some sort of a correction if the buyers really don't step in, particularly after such a huge rally. You know, the S&P 500, like many of the other indexes, from the March lows of 2020, a double to the peak, or even more than a double. I mean, that's a pretty significant statement that you could have these indexes going up so much. So just a little bit of cooling off on, again, the micro, wondering what will these earnings reports come out. And the supply chain, you know, there's this great chart that we've been passing around here today and yesterday
I love when you nerds do that and you pass around a chart.
Who are you calling a nerd?
I say that with love because I love charts too. Go ahead.
It's a fun thing to do. And this one's especially great. It's not even a technical analysis chart. It's showing that in the year of 2021, more than 3,000 mentions of supply chain have happened on earnings calls. And in previous years, it's much closer to 1,000. So that's the degree of the constraint coming out of the pandemic. And the big question is, what does it mean for outlooks and what does it mean for margins? That's probably the big piece of what this range in all these indexes represents right now. Uncertainty about, you know, are companies going to be able to continue to put up big results? Will their outlooks be strong? And then going back to the inflation and the rates question too, of course.
It is, Abigail, pretty remarkable to hear what executives from the biggest banks are saying about the economy. Brian Moynihan just now with David Westin saying that Bank of America's activity level is now bigger than before the pandemic, projects U.S. economic growth around 5% in the next quarter, that people have money to spend, balances up 250%. How is this setting the tone for what we can expect from other companies? And look, full caveat here, Dave Wilson reminding me that, you know, these banks are not waiting for products that are on ships off the port of Long Beach in Los Angeles.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I would certainly agree with Dave on that. And the way that I would think about it is it's very clear that all of the Fed liquidity and central bank liquidity and support out of the pandemic has certainly helped Wall Street, but will it continue to help Main Street? We just don't know. And if we continue to have these supply chain issues and labor issues, I mean, Domino's Pizza today, initially when their report came out, they missed sales, and the thought was that it had to do with not as much interest in pizza because of the pandemic, pizza fatigue, basically. And
come on.
They were saying, no way.
I love my pizza.
I love pizza, too. Yeah. I love white pizza. But I love Domino's cheesy bread.
Oh,
too,
so. Learning a lot about the Chartres.
Yes. We have a little bit of a Domino's habit. But in any case, they miss sales not because of demand, but because of labor. They didn't have enough people to take the orders and deliver the pizza.
Not so good.
Yeah, we see that in other sort of retail stores of all sorts.
That's a crisis. That's what I'm going to say. Hey, we got to run. Great, great perspective. Bloomberg News Markets reporter Abigail Doolittle.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.